Hi, I'm Ben McAdams. You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle. I represent the political center. I'm joined by John Dougal on the right and Shireen Gourbani on the left.
Hey, good to have you back.
Thanks for having me back. 2 weeks in a row.
That's right. We're taking the training wheels back off.
All right. This is fun. These days I'm just happy when anybody cares what my opinion is. So it's good to be back.
So I should say, I feel like we did not mention where Natalie is last week.
She wasn't on the bus.
That's right. She wasn't lost. We did lose connection with her one time when she was on a bus tour of Utah, but she is part of a diplomatic
trade mission.
And is in the Middle East. She's in Israel.
Just got back from Israel.
Yes. So anyway, she is coming back, but we are thrilled to have you here.
Well, I can't wait to hear about Natalie's trip. So thank you for having me. I'm always happy to stand in. So I wanted to start maybe on a little bit of a somber note. So Category 3 storm ravaging Puerto Rico these days. Power's out. Puerto Rico's really been hit hard. John, you've spent some time in Puerto Rico.
Yeah, no, I love Puerto Rico. I love the Puerto Rican people. I served an LDS mission down there for a couple years in the mid-'80s. Was back down there 5 years ago after Hurricane Maria for a couple humanitarian trips. And to see the devastation there, it doesn't look like it's as bad as after Maria, but it still is massive. When you're hearing that 1.5 million people are out of power out of an island of about 3 million, and just to see the devastation is just heartbreaking. When I was down there after Maria, about 90% of the island was out of power, and it was out of power for months and months. And this is, people had lost their roofs, and this is an island that rains almost every day, and people were living in that kind of stuff and dealing with situations that we would be outraged riding in the street if it happened here and stuff. And my heart goes out to them, and I anticipate we will have more humanitarian trips reaching down there to try and help them recover from this horrible, hurricane.
You know, it really is heartbreaking. Shireen, did you?
Yeah, I would just add that my understanding is that a lot of questions are being raised about the dollars that came in after Maria and what really is happening in terms of bolstering the infrastructure. But what we also know, and we talk about on this show a lot, is that we're seeing more frequent, higher intensity storms all the time. And so really building up an infrastructure that was already, in need of investment and rebuilding, and then seeing the devastation, then seeing it hit again is absolutely heartbreaking. And I don't know, do you keep in touch with people from there? Is there anything?
Oh, absolutely. There's a strong contingency of Puerto Ricans that live here in Utah.
Yeah.
Connections back down there as well.
So. Yeah. So I'm sure if people are looking for ways to get involved, they would be able to find those. But I would just say that there's kind of a bigger question here about when these dollars are going into these countries after the devastation of something like a natural disaster, how that's being rebuilt, how that's overseen, and really what we can expect in terms of the infrastructure that's coming in. I think we should be asking questions.
Well, our hearts are with the people in Puerto Rico and those here in Utah who have family and loved ones back there.
That's right.
What a really awful situation.
And a lot of folks don't understand kind of the magnitude of a hurricane. I mean, think to yourself, this is an island that's 100 miles by 30 miles, so basically the size of the Wasatch Front, with a storm that's the size of Utah. And this storm just dwarfs the island. And it's hours and hours and a day of just the wind beating and the rain just pummeling the island. And I think most of us had never been through a situation like that.
So this is the second big storm in not too many years, right, that just ravaged Puerto Rico.
Yeah.
And we're seeing, whether it's storms in the Caribbean or, these hurricanes, we're seeing even right here in Utah with our drought and
fire
and what's happening with the Great Salt Lake. All of these things seem to indicate an increasing pace of climate change and climate disasters. In fact, the UN General Assembly is meeting this week, and the Secretary General called on the world to take action on some big challenges we're facing, and actually called out that we've kind of lost ground on whether it's addressing poverty, addressing climate change, the war in Ukraine, and really took people to task. And we're seeing this play out right in front of our very eyes.
Right? Yeah, that's right. So I have to say that resonates with me. I don't spend a ton of time with young people as a 40-year-old lady, but I think—
As Ben and I look at you as the youngster in the room—
But when I do, engage on, college campuses or with college students or high school students, I hear all the time just the deep disappointment that they have. And Natalie talks about, I think, kind of this broader sense that our institutions are sort of failing, or there's a perception that they're failing and we're losing faith in those institutions. Young kids have been there. They see it, and they see it from everything from rolling back on voting rights, to reproductive rights, to our inability to really meet the challenges that we're seeing with the climate disaster we're living in right now, on and on and on down the line. There are so many things that I think where we really are failing the next generations.
Well, speaking of failure, I want to change to another topic, and that is the tragedy that we're seeing at the border. And then most recently with the migrants who were taken from Texas and shipped to Martha's Vineyard. And I think from on a human level, just such a tragedy, and to see them used as ploys or a stunt. But you know, it also is another example of where we as a country are failing.
Yeah.
So, Ben, let me ask you a question. As you see the news, talk about the disparity you see between, if you will, what conservatives are reading in the media versus what liberals are reading.
Yeah. So we were talking about this before the show, before you got here, Shireen. But so interesting to see. It depends on it, it's another example. First of all, it is a tragedy, right? And I think we can all acknowledge that. But how there's almost two realities depending on where you get your news. So I kind of get a sense for this because I have social media people who I'm connected with on social media across the spectrum, and I'm seeing.
I see straddles both sides of the aisle.
Yeah, exactly. My conservative friends who are talking about the hypocrisy of Martha's Vineyard wine and cheese liberals who are turning away these migrants who were dumped on their doorstep. And then in the news that I'm consuming, I'm seeing the tragedy and people who came out and compassionately worked to solve the immediate need and to help these
shelter,
and set up shelter
get
and
food.
Everything to help these people. And then, you know, there's just not a facility on Martha's Vineyard where they can go. And so, you know, there seems to be like two different realities depending on where you get your news. And I have to say, having been to the border, seen the tragedy at the border, I do acknowledge that there has been failure on both sides of the aisle. And you know, Texas, Arizona, some of these border states are really bearing the brunt of a humanitarian tragedy that's happening on their doorstep. And they've been left, in, to many accounts, all alone to deal with this because of the failure, I think, in Washington.
Yeah.
But what do we think about this?
So I have many thoughts. I will first say that it's...
Remember, this is a short show.
I know. It's difficult for me to hear somebody like Yale and Harvard-educated Ron DeSantis tell other people that they're elites, and then the inhumanity of lying to people to put them onto planes with promises of jobs, food, resources, basically telling them that they've won a lottery. And to be clear, these individuals, in particular the DeSantis issue, is people who are here who have claimed asylum and they are fleeing a deeply violent and crumbling country and home in Venezuela. Okay, so they have a legal right to be here under the process as it exists. They were lied to. Families, children put on planes, taken to Martha's Vineyard, where they do not have the infrastructure. And frankly, there are many times when migrants coming across the border are moved north, but that is done through coordination and many other charities that are coming together, including here. We have, you know, people here who are working to try to create a landing place for these individuals. That this was done as a stunt without coordination is inhumane and, to me, is a full dereliction of duty. And I do not think that people who would take that kind of extreme action as a political stunt should be allowed to serve in office. It is beyond, it's not heartbreaking, it is enraging to me. But I also very much agree. We have had numerous opportunities where we've had Democrats in power, where we've had Republicans in power. No one will move forward on this issue. And it is beyond time to see legislative action, especially as we think about the fact that we need more workers in this country. We have lots of people that could move into positions if we brought them onto the books, if we did a process that was humane, and we need to do it. So I could go on, but John, what are you thinking?
One of the key things, I'll just note that this is one of the issues that all three of us agree on, which is the problem at the border and how the federal government has failed to deal with it for decades and decades. I agree. I have concerns about the if you will, the stunt, the methodology, but I think it does highlight a problem. These, especially southern border states, are dealing with a massive influx of migrants, some legal, many illegal, and to see various places that are saying, hey, we're sanctuary cities, and then folks being shipped off to those cities, and then they're outraged about what happens, highlights kind of the hypocrisy. This sounds like NIMBY, not in my backyard. You know, it's okay to say we want this and we want that and we want the other, but as soon as it starts hitting your doorstep, no, we don't support it. And to see, for example, up Martha's Vineyard, as I understand it, was 50 migrants were shipped up there. I think it was 125 National Guards folks were deployed to deal with it. It seemed like a very overreaction to the situation, which just highlights the seriousness of the problem that we have to say, let's focus on understanding what is the concern of those governors and say, okay, how do we start to deal with this issue? And it, the big part of it rests in D.C. with immigration.
Right. That's right. I just have to say, though, it wasn't just Martha's Vineyard, right? We are also seeing
New York, Chicago.
Right. And Mayor Adams of New York is saying, we got on a phone call. We tried to work with, you know, tried to work with Texas to understand, to get coordination, and they would not cooperate. And that is where, to me, we're outside of, like, I understand what you're saying, but it is a stunt. This is a political stunt, and these are human beings, and I'm just disgusted by this action.
But you're hearing Mayor Adams, and I think he was expressing outrage about 1,000 migrants that were shipped to a city of, what, 30 million people?
Okay.
Versus 2 million at the border that these states are dealing with on a given year. And so his outrage is a little, you know, overblown given some of the situation.
Let's just say this, though. There is a huge opportunity here. I would love to see our governor come out and Governor Cox say, we will take more people here in Utah. And I know that we've done this before on other issues. We've done it before. But when I see Cox signing on to a letter against, you know, student loan forgiveness, I would like to see him signing a letter saying, we are one of those red states. We are not at the border. We can do more. We will be part of the solution. I would love to see our state do that. I would be proud of that.
For me, I think it was, first of all, it's just such a tragedy. We all know that Ron DeSantis wants to be president,
right,
and he was willing to use human lives to get his name out there, to take a victory lap, to garner support. And the fact that he misled people, you know, I'm even seeing talk about looking at this as a human trafficking violation, right? If somebody under a false pretense was transported from one location to another, it does raise the question of whether human trafficking violations were committed, a crime was committed.
And right? He did it on taxpayer dime.
On taxpayer dollar, not in his state.
Not in his state.
In another state. So first of all, that's a tragedy to me. That's so sad, and it is outrageous. But we are failing to address the situation at the border, Republicans and Democrats. I went to the border as a member of Congress and saw, you know, the day that I went there, we'd heard about thousands of people crossing the border. When I got there, there were probably 50 people at the border. And we asked what was happening, and they told us. So we got to interview some of the, I speak a little bit of Spanish, so got to talk to some of the people who were in the receiving facility. And then we asked the Customs and Border Patrol, how many people were under the thumb of the cartel to get across the border. And they said that they do an intake questionnaire. 100% of the people who cross the border have been subject to the cartels to get across the border. And what they said happened, the reason that there were only 50 people when we were there, the cartel will hold them back until they build up a certain number, and then they send them all across at once. So Customs and Border Patrol is overwhelmed. And they can shuttle drugs across the border. So they are using these human lives. It's not just Ron DeSantis, but it is the cartel who's also using these human lives for their own evil purposes.
Well, and this is why I've talked about the importance of a wide legal doorway for folks to come in, because rational people will take the plane, take the bus, come in the legal way. And then who are crossing illegally? Truly the bad folks.
Have a logical path to open the front door, and then I'm all for shutting the back door.
Right? Yeah.
Open the front door, shut the back door, secure the border, but have a logical path for people to come in. That's right.
There are solutions.
Yeah. Well, you're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle. I'm Ben McAdams with Shireen Gourbani and John Dougal. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle on KCPW. For more episodes of all our in-house podcasts, click on the Local Programs tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider donating to KCPW to support public radio in your community.
Shireen Gourbani, on the left.
John Dougal, on the right.
I'm Ben McAdams in the political middle. You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle. So we were talking about the border and some of the stunts from Ron DeSantis. You know, we have everybody, it seems like these days, is running for president. So I saw Gavin Newsom challenging Ron DeSantis for a debate, right? And we talked about a lot of the
probably not the Lincoln Douglas style, but
no, a lot of grandstanding, I think, from all parties. But you know, we're talking about some of the ESG challenges, so environment, social, governance, and speaking of that, so we've seen some headlines being made here in Utah. Right.
Yeah.
So Marlo Oaks, Utah state treasurer, who oversees Utah retirement systems, the state pension fund that funds the retirement for all of Utah employees, pulling $100 million out of BlackRock. John.
So not quite that. What it was is the PTIF, the Public Treasurer's Investment Fund, which is where cities and counties in the state have their short term, if you will, money at. It's not the state pension system with the long term investments. That's the Utah retirement system, of which he's a board member. But it's the chief investment officer that makes those decisions.
So what is
his concern?
Explain
his duty. He has a legal fiduciary duty to ensure the best return for the beneficiaries of those funds. So in this case, cities and counties and so forth who have money invested with him. His concern is that BlackRock is investing in political activities that are not necessarily intended to give the best return for the investors. And so therefore, he has to look and say, okay, are they playing politics? And should I have the money invested elsewhere where they have that singular focus on fiduciary responsibility? And so that's where he is saying, I have concerns. Now, when you step back and listen to the dynamics of BlackRock, you will hear them talk a lot about, basically, if you will, a lot of liberal agendas on different things. But as I look at it, there's also this element which seems like they want companies to divest in a certain way in the states, you know, to drive a liberal agenda. At the same time, they seem to be holding the hand of China to have them buy these assets that American companies are divesting of. And so it almost looks like they're creating churn to make money playing both sides of the fence.
You know, I saw this, I watched this play out too, and I took a different approach to it. So, you know, I see this as, you know, fundamental Republican philosophy, and I will say philosophy that by and large I agree with, and that is that markets can be a force for good, properly regulated with proper guardrails. Markets can be a force for good, and government's job is to place those guardrails, but not to get in the middle and to plan the economy, to plan and micromanage the markets. And what I saw, it seems like Marlow Oaks, and there's a trend around the country with this, of people who are intervening in investment decisions where really what these investment managers should be doing is managing those funds for the ultimate fiduciary of the investors, right? So, and I see BlackRock saying is they're seeing, looking forward at the forecast of some of these investments in carbon-intensive industries, the future is, you know, there's writing on the wall.
Yeah. Now remember,
so they're making a fiduciary decision to not invest in some of these carbon-intensive activities. And the state of Utah is intervening and saying you have to direct your investments in a certain way.
Well, so there's a little twist here. So they're not saying you and I
and
restricting how BlackRock deals with our money.
Right, sure.
The state is saying this is their money that they're investing, and therefore they don't want politics involved. They want to focus on singular focus on fiduciary activity. That's in essence what's happening. So it's a little twist on kind of what you described.
Yeah, but it just seems like the tables
and,
are
and Shireen disagrees as I hear a little chuckle.
Go
over
ahead,
there.
Shireen.
So politics are clearly involved, right? And I just have to note the quote from BlackRock, which was, we're not environment, but they're focused on their capitalists and they are looking at those fiduciary responsibilities to their clients.
BlackRock, the epitome of wokeness.
It's clearly not, if you know anything about it.
Well, in the realm of other stuff.
Although Larry Fink has been backpedaling over the last year. He had gone out there tip of the spear on a lot of things and has backpedaled on some of it now.
To me, it just seems like political or economic philosophy out the door. It's politics above all else. And we've just seen the tables turned on what Republicans believe in and what their actions are. But let's turn to a different stunt.
Okay.
We saw a letter from the state legislature. Tell us what that was, Shireen.
Yeah. So this was a letter that arrived to Planned Parenthood and abortion providers in our state really saying that it was a cease and desist letter penned by Representatives Kara Berkland and then also Representative Carrie Ann Lisenby. This had multiple other legislators sign on to it. And the problem with this is when it's on official letterhead and when it arrives and it's a cease and desist letter, you would think that that was a legitimate part of a legal system or a notification, but it simply wasn't. It was their opinion. And when we think about kind of turning the tables, the rule of law used to be something that seemed to matter quite a bit to Republicans. But in this case, to me, I think it is a violation. Well, certainly it's not what's happening legally. We have a legal ban on the very harsh abortion ban that we have in our state, and that is going through the courts right now. There is a legal process set up for that to move through the courts and to be reviewed. This letter is really the opinion of these individuals that, abortion care providers should stop doing that. To put it on official letterhead to me is really concerning. And then, frankly, there was quite a bit of backpedaling. The representatives came out and said, well, this is our opinion. This is just what we think should happen. Well, you get to sit in the seat and make laws. You get to do, you know, the work that is done. When there is a legal process playing out, let that legal process play out. And I do think this was a political stunt, and it does continue to confuse people. But for listeners, people who are seeking this kind of care, understand that abortion is still legal up to 18 weeks in Utah. You have the right to access that kind of care should you need it. So I think this is problematic. It's confusing. I also think it's just an overstepping of roles.
And one of the things here, when I was a legislator and I sent a letter, I didn't have anybody ever confused that that I was speaking for the House or the legislature as a whole when it was just my letter going out.
Right.
Clearly, we have a process. The Attorney General's office is dealing with the litigation on this matter. My understanding is this. I haven't seen the letter, but my understanding is the Attorney General's office nor Legislative Research and General Counsel, neither of them were involved in drafting this letter. It was truly a letter of
their
a set of legislators with their opinion.
Yeah.
So content from the letter aside, I think that's the other concern, is using what appears to be the authority, speaking on behalf of and with the authority of the state of Utah, when really what it is a personal opinion, right?
So, right.
Right. But we would do that even when we were legislators. We'd send a letter.
You're entitled to, right?
We're entitled with.
Totally.
But I had letterhead that didn't look like, that wasn't the state letterhead. It was Office of Ben McAdams letterhead. Right, that
yeah.
It would look different, and I think that legislators are entitled to their own opinion.
Completely.
They're entitled to express that opinion, whether we find it repugnant or not. They're entitled to express that opinion, but they shouldn't be doing it under the guise of representing the authority of the and the opinion of the state legislature, the state of Utah itself.
Right, the entire body.
Yeah. Well, I want to talk back to stock trading. So we're talking about There's another one.
Show us the money, Ben.
Yeah.
Show us the money.
The Democrats. This is a Democrat on Democrat battle. So you, John, you've got to be loving this in Congress.
I got my popcorn. I'm just watching. There's an old saying, when your friends are self-destructing, don't interrupt.
Well, that's right.
The Democrats are really good about giving you these shows, this source of entertainment. And so Democrats in Congress, there's been a debate about banning stock trading by members of Congress. And so let me tell you why this is a problem, right? So as a member of Congress, especially more senior member of Congress, you are able to move the markets. If I'm, the chair of Senate Appropriations, and I'm going to appropriate $5 billion into vaccine research.
Sure.
And I go out the day before I do that and buy stock in Moderna. Moderna stocks can go up when I announce
that
I'm making that announcement, right? Or any other number of announcements. So the notion, at least, and it is actually illegal to trade on inside information. So if I know that Congress is going to do something that's going to move the market and I trade on that activity, that is a crime. But what's not a crime is to maybe if you can't, it's hard to prove, right? What did you know and when did you know it? So maybe I'm on the Senate Appropriations Committee or maybe I'm on the Health and Human Services Committee and I invest a lot in healthcare stock, right? It just gives the appearance of being improper.
Yeah.
So there's legislation to say members of Congress cannot trade individual stocks. You can invest in mutual funds that where somebody else is making the investment decision, or index funds. I'm a proponent of this. When I was in Congress, I'm not necessarily a wealthy person, but my retirement, my 401k is all invested in funds that somebody else is making the investment. And I think that's just smart.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
You're hoping it's smart.
But, but Democrats are, doing
unwilling.
A great job of putting on a show for everybody. And I think it's unfortunate.
They're slow walking the thing.
Yeah. I would love to see this get done. I'm with you. I think that it would be I think a deep sense that people are, often in these offices to benefit themselves. And you see that in the way that sometimes careers also take place after people leave Congress. But really, generally speaking, I think that this would be something that would be good for transparency, and it helps restore a little faith in the institution.
Yeah. Okay, so we've talked about some heavy topics. Let's end on a positive note. Good news, everybody. The pandemic is over.
Oh.
Yay. Ding dong. The witch is dead.
At least that's what Joe Biden tells us. What do we think about that?
But the emergency lives on.
Yeah. We still have, we just crossed 5,000 deaths in Utah. The chances are that someone listening here has lost someone close to them. And that is heartbreaking. And I think about that a lot. And we're continuing to see numerous deaths across this entire country every day. It is, though, I think, an indication that we need to move into thinking about this differently. And I hope people are getting their boosters and, making those plans. But we have to think about it more like the flu.
Yeah, it is. It is different. It's moving into a different phase. Maybe.
Yeah.
Well, and clearly he's following public sentiment. If you go around Utah, around the nation, people have moved past it.
Yeah. I mean, it's hard to see people. I think it's still important to follow the guidance, to, as Shireen said, to get the booster, to be responsible. But also, people are going back to their normal lives and they're ready to go back. I see that even with myself and my family. COVID hit me really hard.
Yeah.
I spent 10
really
days in
hard.
The hospital, right? I didn't even know what a pulse oximeter was. I don't think any of us did at the time. But my oxygen levels were 81 when I was in the hospital. So it was scary for me. And I have every reason to be worried. And yet, I do find it hard to, I feel like we are kind of moving on, right?
Yeah.
But just encourage people to, again, it's with us, but let's take the necessary steps, necessary precautions. So let's end with a PSA.
Yeah.
We each of us have a PSA that we're going to give. Let me start with mine. we are entering the final stretch of the campaigns. So debates are starting here soon. The first debate will be on October 6th, moderated by both sides of the aisle's very own Natalie Gochner. This will be the third district debate between Glenn Wright and John Curtis on October 6th. And we'll have debates all the way through on October 17th, the debate between Senator Mike Lee and challenger Evan McMullen. If you want more, go to utahdebatecommission.org.
Okay, mine's really quick. Please, if you are a listening Utah politician or aspiring, stop rapping.
We just celebrated National Voter Registration Day. Go to vote.utah.gov to check on your registration.
You've been listening to Both Sides of the Aisle. I'm Ben McAdams. I've been joined by Shireen Gurbani and John Dougal. Thank you to our producer, Anthony Scoma, and thanks to you, the listener.